Right, Cabinet today, if I can find my way between these microphones. We approved New Zealand AIDS policy on promoting environmental sustainability and poverty elimination through our aid programs. Quite an important policy statement, and one sees those two objectives featuring a number of the aid programs New Zealand AIDS does offshore now. I remember one went to see in the Philippines where the dolphin watching was helping village livelihoods. That was important. Also noted a review on progress towards the goals of New Zealand Positive Ageing Strategy, and that's going to be released. We've had a Cabinet Business Committee today dealing with the Cabinet Committee papers, which are not ready to be announced. We've reviewed the hydro situation, as we always do, and I see the South Island lakes are now at 76% full again, and quite a pleasing graph on the yellow line at that point. In terms of what's coming up this week, well, this week of a recess, and I myself am out and about around the provinces, down to Dunedin tonight, then going up to the west coast and then to the Waikato. And I think you'll find that ministers are fanning out and about far and wide as caucus members and committees. Coming up today, if it hasn't already, Damien O'Connor will be releasing terms of reference from Alfred Hall Advertising Review panel. Coming out midweek, Mark Burton will issue the stock take of the National Plan of Action against the commercial sexual exploitation of children. Pete Hodgson leaves later in the week to go to the United Nations General Assembly Special Summit on HIV/AIDS. I've specially asked him to go. It's clear the summit's been conducted at a high level with a lot of ministerial and head of government representation, and alas, the HIV AIDS problem is one which continues to be with us in great numbers. Obviously, we've spent some time today on the issue of the Timor deployment, because the crisis in Timor has largely blown up since the Cabinet Policy Committee met last Wednesday and first started to engage with officials on the possibility of quite significant deployments for New Zealand. And since then, there's been a huge amount of work go on by officials, of course, particularly by Defence, who had to get ready for quite significant deployments. Officials started meeting late into the night on Wednesday night, and then again a great deal of activity Thursday and Friday. Thursday and Friday night I consulted with other ministers who have power to act on issues of this kind, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Acting Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Defence, Acting Minister of Defence, Honourable Jim Anderton. And we took a range of decisions across Thursday and Friday night, which meant that we sent the air movement control teams up to North Australia, about eight specialists in air logistics, decided to deploy the 757 to be available for tasking in and out of Timor, as well as some transport back out of Solomon Islands for both New Zealand and Australian personnel, to deploy a C-130 available for tasking in and out of Timor, deploy the infantry platoon first up to Darwin. That decision was taken on the Thursday night, and then when we were satisfied that the interim force and agreement that Australia was leading had its proper establishment set up, then we agreed to the forward deployment of the platoon onto Dili and to deploy the infantry company, which is heading further north from Townsville now to go into Dili in the next couple of days, and as well the headquarters team is set in. So there's been a lot of working with phones and working official reports over all that. And as we speak, we have the 42 personnel on the ground. We have 130 people associated with the company, which is heading further north in Australia before deployment. We intend to send military police up as well, with specific duties around the embassy protection. So all up, that comes to about 180 people, plus the 8 who are in air logistics work around Darwin. And we are coordinating very, very closely with the Australian Defence Force. I spoke to John Howard on Friday night. Kofi Annan made contact the night before, and clearly the United Nations is watching these developments very closely. The latest figures I had for internally displaced persons in Timor, just as I came down here, were about 100,000 people. And you'll appreciate out of that very small population, it's a huge amount. And of course, when you have so many people on the move to makeshift accommodation and informal camps, you do have the humanitarian crisis in the making. So we're following that very closely. We've made our first contribution, but we remain ready to do more. In terms of the Kiwis up there, well, there's currently 33. The numbers do go up and down because as New Zealanders have been living and working there leave, media come in. So it's a bit of a revolving door, but we've been able to establish contact with everyone except two who live in remote locations, and there's no reason to believe that they've come to any harm. So a lot of work going on around that. And just on the Job Jakarta issue, we announced the initial contribution to the relief appeal launched by the Red Cross yesterday. I have written to the Indonesian President, and Mr. Peters has written to the Foreign Minister, offering support and further assistance should they ask. And New Zealand Aid is currently looking at proposals to provide assistance to local and provincial coordinating bodies for disaster relief in the Job Jakarta area, as we would like to strengthen the Indonesian government's capacity to deal with the tragedy. Of the 12 registered Kiwis in the Job Jakarta area, we've been able to ascertain that 8 are safe and sound and accounted for. With the others, we have no information at all. Some may have moved on. Certainly there is no one at a hospital who is a New Zealander at the present time. So, any questions? Well, the deployment is very much governed by logistics and synchronising very carefully with Australia. The Australian Defence Force has a forced insertion plan, as it's called, and that's what we're working to. When we do hit the ground running, it will be fully equipped and moving to duty, and that's the way the plan's been worked through. Well, the current expectation is on the ground running on Wednesday. In essence, they'll be deployed according to what the most urgent task is. When we went in with the platoon on Saturday, the most urgent task was to provide security immediately to the embassy, which, as you know, had been under some considerable threat. We then moved on to do other duties, including providing some security around a military base. There had been concern at some points that people were simply handing out arms from bases. That needed to stop. And when we hit the ground running with the company, I would imagine we're very much dealing with patrolling and local duties. And the advice we have from Timor today is that there is now no effective Timorese police force whatsoever. So there is no local police. And it's very dependent on the build-up of the international force to deal with those basic law and order issues.
What communications have you had with your counterparts in the Timorese government?
We've been working through our ambassador in Dili, Ruth Nuttall, and also through the defence attaché and police liaison officer, and the New Zealanders have been with the UN mission in Timor. So all the connection has been through our representatives there.
Yeah, the police force, Australia are sending 45 police officers to Timor to try and fill that void. Will we be sending police there ourselves at some stage?
Well, firstly, right now, it's not at the point where you hand over from the green uniforms to the blue uniforms, but the Australians are looking at putting in some support. And our police force is now looking at options as to what they could do if a request comes to help in that way.
I think back to square one, is Timor back to where you were in
1997? It's tempting to say so, very tempting. The circumstances on the ground in Dili of willful homicide, wanton destruction of people's homes and properties and public property is not dissimilar to what we witnessed in 1999, a total breakdown of law and order and communal violence and people settling scores with each other. The extent of it certainly did. We've been obviously receiving reports from our embassy and from discussion we have with other friends in the region like Australia about the growing tension in Timor. We obviously had some concerns when around 40% of the Timorese army was dismissed, because dismissing soldiers to go to no pay and rations is often a recipe for disaster. So you had really a political crisis which then spilled out into an inability to run an army or a police force or to show any leadership at all in a very, very fractious political climate. And that spiraled out of control extremely quickly. Now obviously for some time before last Wednesday we had had a platoon on standby to evacuate nationals. But to see it disintegrate to the extent it did was not anticipated. I think the political crisis has quite long-term roots. It is basically differences within the ruling party, threatening party, where there are clearly factions. Some support the Prime Minister, some don't. There have been long-term differences between the President, Mr. Kushner, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Alfatouri. That hasn't helped either. It's been a government which has been getting into more and more political strife. But to see it blow out of control like this, I don't think could have been anticipated.
The Australians reported today that the United Nations is contemplating sending a full peacekeeping mission back into Timor. Do you see that as being a logical or likely step?
We haven't been able to substantiate the report that the UN is considering a full mission again, but clearly it's going to have to come up with a new plan, because as it was, the UN was edging towards not having a mission there at all. That clearly isn't now practical. When Kofi Annan made contact late on Thursday night, he told me then he was going to send in one of his most experienced political operators, by which he meant someone who had experience in dealing with troubled countries before. And he was clearly of a mind to say to the Security Council that this was not only no time to leave, but they had to completely rethink the plan of operation there. So whether that leads to a broader international force than the four countries who were invited to go by the Timorese government and backed by the UN Security Council as well, whether it leads to broader international force or whether it leads to some kind of regionally based force, I couldn't say at the moment. At the moment we're trying to deal with the immediate crisis. I have a feeling that we're going to see New Zealand military there for the rest of this year and into next. The question will be at what level. As you know, with Solomon Islands, we've been there since mid-2003, but at different levels. We had to scale up again in the last month. We're now beginning to scale down again. So whether with Timor it would require an ongoing contribution of the up to 200 that we've authorised or something smaller remains to be seen. But the feeling of both John Howard and Kofi Annan, who I've spoken to directly in recent days, is they feel an outside presence is going to be needed through to elections in Timor next year. The UN certainly will play a role, because that's why they're sending one of their most experienced operators to come in and start engaging with the Timor government on some process of political reconciliation which can take the country ahead. And I think at its root, this is a political and leadership failure of considerable dimensions. And up until relatively recent times, the UN had been inclined to pronounce Timor as a success story. We can now see that it was a very, very fragile democracy which had been constructed.
Do you think the Prime Minister should stand down and they should bring forward fresh elections?
Well, I don't think it would be appropriate for me to get involved in saying what should happen within the Timorese government. There is some indication today that they may form a crisis cabinet, but again, watch the space. Our immediate concern is to try and contribute to bringing greater security on the street right now.
Yeah, there's been some advice that it wasn't so much a civil insurrection, but a result of a deliberate coup attempt. What advice have you received about
that? Well, that's the view that Mr. Alkatiri has promulgated. But, of course, there are significant political differences within that government and within the ruling party. I don't really have a view on that. What I know is that it's a major failure of leadership.
Have you got any reports on what the Indonesian response to all of this is, and whether or not there's any danger of this escalating beyond East Timor? I know there's 100,000 displaced people elsewhere.
Well, I don't think they're heading for the border with Indonesia. They're heading for safety in the vicinity of the Dili area, or perhaps home to their villages. I think it's a sign of how far things have come with the establishment of a much more democratic regime in Indonesia, that there's no sign of Indonesia taking any adverse interest whatsoever. If anything, its interest will be constructive. And that's a huge change from where we were at only 7 or 8 years ago.
So there's no border tension there?
Not that's been reported to me, no.
A question today about him being a patriot and nationalist, presumably in response to Labour's painting him as unpatriotic last week. What's your response to bringing up problems in the country?
Well, I'm simply interested. He felt he had to make the speech. He's very much on the record as basically praising other places as places to live rather than our own country, and I don't think that goes down to him.
But if he is leader of the opposition,
that's involved in bringing up what he sees as wrong with the system, and that's not necessarily making him leader. I think we could put all sorts of constructions on that, but I don't tend to pay the speech a great deal of attention.
What about GST and the silver that national will seek lead to
Well, the first I heard of it was when I saw it on the wires, which is a funny way to go around garnering support for a bill. I expect they'll be in contact in due course about it. Probably raise it at the business committee.
Would you agree with the support?
I really haven't had any advice on the bill whatsoever. Clearly they need legislation to fix the problem they've got in themselves, because a party led by a former Reserve Bank government didn't understand GST. You know, we'll have to have a look at it. I've no idea what stance we'll take on the bill, because I haven't seen it, and apart from seeing a media headline on a screen, I know nothing about it. Look, I'm really not commenting on its substance, because I've never seen it.
Did you hear the video call that came out last night from my London one who's having small gaps by the national support for the wages? Do you think that is budget in a way, or is there a fear that the cuts will put people on the Australian economy?
Well, I've given you my views on that particular poll on a number of occasions. That was the poll that 2 nights before the last election told us we were 6 or 7 points behind, and on the day we were 2 points ahead. My view is that it is probably the least accurate of all the polls that were taken, and it is certainly not in line with other polling that's around. Well, you've got to remember that in relatively recent times, New Zealand has sustained a battalion in Timor of 600 plus people. Now, right now we're gearing up to about 200 people. We have a little over 100 in a provincial reconstruction team in Afghanistan, and we will settle at about a platoon in the Solomons. So even with this increased deployment, it's still less than half of what we have in Timor at any one time, only 4 or 5 years ago.
Are you concerned about what looks like more instability in the Southeast Asia region, as an ally at that time?
I think there is a growing perception that the Pacific is quite fragile, and in many respects Timor, as quite a small country, has a lot more similarities perhaps with parts of the Pacific than it does with Asia as such. But clearly there's been an arc of instability through Melanesia for quite some time. And one of the reasons we seized the initiative during the chairing of the Pacific Island Forum in 2003-04 was to work on concerted regional strategies, which eventually became the Pacific Plan, to get some of these fundamental issues addressed. We're dealing in a region that are very fragile states. No, I don't believe so. I believe they went in as quickly as was practicable. And you might recall when we first got the request from Timor, and from recollection that was Wednesday night, but the days tended to blur into each other, the request actually was for us to go to the border and to relieve their troops to come into town. I mean, even at that point, there wasn't as much of a danger being presented to respond to as eventually it built up to later in the week.
There's no reports on your own staff on the ground yet, but there's need to do that as well.
Of course, we've been concerned, but for concern to be realised, it needs to go up a level, and it escalated quite suddenly.
So, the team
reached out
to the medical programs.
That's a possibility, but I think they've been immersed in their own political struggles and probably losing control of their forces to a greater extent and more rapidly than they could have envisaged. It took a little while for the letter to come in. So it was starting to be suggested, as you know, from Jose Ramos Horta that he was getting in touch with us, and then eventually a letter came, and it was on that night that officials started a concerted daily meeting to deal with these issues. Sorry, I'm having a bit of difficulty hearing you, Ruth. Can you speak up?
Oh, only
Well, firstly, the oscillators and crystals are not on the list of goods which are prohibited. And that list is not compiled by New Zealand. That list is compiled by international export control bodies under four international conventions, which we're a party to, so we follow that. Now, subsequent to the advice I had yesterday, a further piece of advice came forward, and that was offered by Mr. Gough on the report this morning, by me on the Homes Programme, and that is that where a product is being designed specifically for use in military equipment, then clearance should be sought. Now, obviously, the government will then have a decision to make as to whether it thought it was appropriate to give that clearance, and that would very much depend on whether it was a nuclear weapon or not, and would very much depend on the destination of the export. Well, if they are making a product specifically for insertion in a military weapon, then they may well need to get clearance for that. But that's what we're trying to establish. It's unfortunate that the journalist didn't actually come to us before completing the article, or go to Raycon before completing the article, because then it could have been a fuller picture at the time. As it is, you know, we're stuck with a range of questions on Saturdays and Sundays when it's not so easy to get the answers. From Raycon, not that I'm aware of. Well, we only have the authority of the New Zealand Herald, which suggests that they're making items specifically for insertion in a weapon. Now, we are bound to follow that up, because if that's what they are doing, if it has been specifically designed for use in a military guidance and navigation system, then it may well be that they should have been seeking clearance.
Will you get that clearance?
Well, we've got to get to the bottom of it yet, so I would presume. Well, first you have to establish the facts. Are they actually making something which is specifically to be a part of a weapon? And if they are, should they have got a clearance for it? So it's really fact-finding at this stage. It's not really about the US, it's about what happens at this end, where the export actually goes from. So, to repeat precisely what Mr. Gough said, if the items that are being produced are produced specifically for military use, yes, then approval and an export permit would be required, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is being asked to check again. Well, that again would depend on whether it was a nuclear or non-nuclear weapon. I think the answer is pretty obvious on the nuclear weapon. On the non-nuclear weapon, depending on the country, you'd make a judgment.